You're listening to The Rick Smith Show on the Progressive Voices Network.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is The Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here tonight on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Immigration, guns, child labor, Cohen, Jr., Trump, manic meltdown. Oh, it is a coming. But yesterday's big election here in Pennsylvania, the primary. Good stuff coming out of the state and looking forward to November. Across the country, you had four states holding primaries yesterday, Pennsylvania, Oregon, Idaho, and Nebraska. And it was a good day for Democratic women. 18 Democratic women won their primaries and special elections yesterday. That is a good step in the right direction. Here in Pennsylvania, eight women of the 18 congressional seats won their primaries, seven Democrats, one Republican. Three of the Democrats have a really good shot. So it could be, don't hold your breath, but it could be that Pennsylvania could have a woman representative. I know. That hasn't happened since Alison Schwartz, I believe, about a decade ago. I mean, has it been that long? Yeah. So there you go. Alison Schwartz was the last one. All 18 have been men. This next election could see 3, 4, 5, maybe even 7. But at least 3. I'm pretty confident on the 3 in the 4th, 5th, and 6th districts. Pretty confident that is going to happen. So good on them. A couple of our friends won their primaries. Going to be nice to see them. Some reelected, some elected for the first time. Looking forward to that. It's going to be an interesting summer because some of the people I saw on the right, wow, some real fringe folks. And also out in Western Pennsylvania, a couple of moderate Democrats took a shellacking, as they probably should have. So good on those folks out there as well. But today, the big story, at least in my view, today was a ton of big stories. The Senate Intelligence Committee out with their report, basically turning against the House Republicans. So you got the Senate Republicans saying, yeah, there was meddling going on. House Republicans go, no meddling. We didn't see anything, nothing to see. Move along. We'll maybe get to some of that. But Rex Tillerson, former Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson gave the big speech. I'm sure everyone has heard about it. He was at the Virginia Military Institute, VMI, and gave the big speech, which, you know, some were saying, you know, this is a veiled swat at Donald Trump. This is a veiled swat at the Republicans. There was nothing veiled about this. He went right at the heart of what I've been saying for a long time. Because what Trump and Giuliani and the whole clan have really tried to do is muddy the waters to the point where nothing we see, nothing we hear, nothing that comes out of government or the newspapers or anywhere other than right-wing blather is factual. You know, they've done fake news. Everything's fake news. And I've had people who've who've come on the show and go, you know, I've had people call me fake news. And I'm going, that's not surprising, given the world that we live in. Anyway, Tillerson, and I got to read a couple of the quotes from the speech. It was a, you know, for a guy who's boring, and he is, he's kind of like listening to paint dry. The words were powerful. At one point he said, as I reflect upon the state of our American democracy, I observe a growing crisis in ethics and integrity. Do you think that was pointed at anyone, maybe in particular, maybe someone with, oh, I don't know, a lawyer that pays off porn stars that he had an affair with and then lied about? You know, maybe, just maybe, ethics, integrity. He says, when we as people, a free people, go wobbly on the truth, even on what may seem the most trivial matters, kind of like a porn star and lying about it, we go wobbly on America. And I'm going, wow, those are really powerful words. When facts don't matter anymore, when the truth doesn't matter anymore, what do you have? He continues, if we do not, as Americans, confront the crisis of ethics and integrity in our society and among our leaders, both in public and private sector, and regrettably, at times, even the nonprofit sector, then American democracy, as we know it, is entering its twilight years. And I would argue we're in those twilight years, given what we see coming out of this administration. Virtually nothing that they say is factual, is 100% factual. It's always the sleight of hand. It's always the con. It's always the graft. It's always an omission of this or that, or trying to skirt reality and truth. So when I read this and I'm going, wow, it's incredible. And, you know, he even hit on something that I've said 1,000 times. You know, you look at this cowardly new world of alternative facts that we seem to find ourselves. And he said that, you know, we need to have a common set of facts. And that these common facts, they're essential to maintaining a free society. And I've been saying this for a very long time. It used to be back in the old days, there were things that we kind of all agreed on. It's not, we've splintered into all these factions. If you go back and you read some of the writings of Jefferson and John Jay and Madison and, you know, the Federalist Papers, and one of the fears that they had in 10 was, you know, this splintering and these factions and, you know, basically us, you know, kind of eating each other, which is kind of where we are. He goes on to say, if our leaders seek to conceal the truth, or as we people become accepting of alternative realities that are no longer grounded in facts, then we as American citizens are on the pathway to relinquishing our freedom. You know, and as I heard that, I'm going, you know, this is that kind of call where you go, you know, you've got a fascist authoritarian dictator in the White House. This is a nice way of saying, hey, you might want to listen to what they're saying, because they're taking stuff from you. You don't even know it yet. This is going to be bad. Wake up. He says, a responsibility of every American citizen to each other is to preserve and protect our freedom by recognizing what truth is and is not, what a fact is and is not, and begin by holding ourselves accountable to truthfulness and demand our pursuit of America's future based, fact-based. I don't see anything in there veiled. Do you? I mean, honestly, do you see anything that does not directly apply to this administration? He did go on to tell the VMI cadets that, you know, as they entered the work world, and there was some of that, you know, at one point he said, you know, consider carefully the people that you work for. Make sure they have, you know, good values, and it's a culture of you know, of values and organization and, you know, all that stuff. You know, he says, look for employers who set high standards for ethical conduct. Now, this is a guy who ran an oil company, and, you know, kind of had the whole, you know, ship spill and all, and the, you know, of course, let's not forget the oil in the Gulf. And yeah, but anyway, the words are, hey, high standards, ethics, all that stuff. And again, not to veil. And I read that and I'm going, is he talking about Trump's company? Is he talking about, you know, cheating people out of their wages? I would highly suggest take a couple of minutes. And I'm not a huge Tillerson fan by any stretch of the imagination, but I thought it was a good speech. And some of these commencement speeches, you know, they are high-minded, highbrow, and maybe we should be listening to them instead of our elected leaders. Just kind of a thought. Just throwing that out there. So as we found out today, and I was waiting for it, today was the obviously the day that Donald Trump came out with his financial disclosures, and lo and behold, guess what? Yeah, he paid for it. he on the disclosure form says that he paid Michael Cohen, I think it was like $250,000, $130,000 of which was to go to Stormy, and the other part it was, I'm going, you know, is that excess? Is that somebody else? Are we waiting for the other shoe to drop? Are we waiting for another porn star to come forward? Yeah, Me Too. Is this the next Me Too movement? Where all the people that he has, well, done, comes forward and says, yeah, I got my Donald check as well. But here's the thing, and today's an interesting day for me because, you know, when the Senate Intelligence Committee came out with their report, basically saying, look, you know, Russians did meddle. And then they went through a whole bunch of stuff and you know, refuted what the House had done. And it shows that there's a major divide in the party. You know, I started thinking about, you know, those moments where you go, there are certainly moments. And today also, the transcripts from Junior and the Trump Tower meetings, you know, just flooded us. Some 2,000 pages. I mean, just quite remarkable. I guess like 2,500 documents came out in this. Who's got time to go flipping through those while you're making dinner and, you know, trying to go to work and making sure the kids get their homework done? But you know, it's one of these things where, you know, we knew what they were there for. I mean, it makes no sense that you're not going to be there to try and dig up the dirt on Hillary, and you're not going to be there to try and figure out how to get this Russian lawyer to give you whatever they've got. And that, you know, his email, yeah, I love it. You dig up dirt on her. Oh, yeah, I love it. Yeah, come on. That's 2,500 documents. I don't need to know. I don't need to read those to know that, you know, they wanted dirt. And the Russians, they wanted Hillary out. Because you look at the chaos, the insanity, you look at what Trump has done thus far. Oh, boy, he's the gift that keeps on giving to the Russians. If you wanted to bring this country down, there you go. But, you know, here's the thing. There's been a ton of these moments. And this is where I'm hoping it's one of those things where, you know, I'm so afraid that the Mueller investigation has been so tight-lipped that there haven't been any leaks, that there haven't been any, you know, real, you know, hard document stuff yet. And they've been kind of slowing. I know Manafort got indicted, and I know they went and they got Flynn, and there was Papadopoulos and some of the other stuff, and the 13 Russians and the companies and all that. Yeah, I get that. But I was trying to go through some of the documents that were available online of this meeting in Trump Tower. And my fear is that this investigation is going to be so massive that once they finally try and make their case, it is going to be so enormous and so difficult for the average person to follow that the groundwork that Trump is laying right now, that it's all fake news, it's all a witch hunt, it's all a hoax, there was nothing to see. And even the Republicans in the Senate said, no collusion. Meddling, yes. Collusion, no. My fear is that we miss it. And I think about that meeting at Trump Tower with the Russian asset. I think about Manafort's indictment and a couple of judges saying, nope, sorry, you're going to stand trial. You know, the Papadopoulos meeting with this, what is it? You know, with this, you know, I guess not meeting, he was drunk and he was just blathering on to somebody who evidently this investigation started a year ago, well before the election. And you had the FBI going, well, you know, we didn't really want to get involved in it because we didn't want to look like we had our thumb on it. And I'm going, you know, maybe that was good advice for Comey to not get involved with the email stuff the way he did. But anyway, so there's that. There's also the Seychelles, where you had, you know, Betsy DeVos's brother, the mercenary meeting with some people close to Putin. It just happened to bump into each other. Just, yeah, there's in a bar in the, you know, middle of nowhere, and hey, it just happened to happen. Three guys sitting down at the bar talking about how they're going to screw over the country and create back channels. And then, of course, there's the Michael Cohen raid. And the Cohen raid itself is just... wow. 16 cell phones. I can't imagine how many documents. I can't imagine how many thousands of pages, because as one person told me, he's the only bag man in history to keep everything, like he was archiving it. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens. But like I said, my fear is so big we lose it. But we're going to try and work through it, and we're going to try and keep everybody up to date, and love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. When we come back, I'm going to talk about guns, the no NRA movement, some sanity on that front with Ben Jackson. He is a fantastic blogger over at Dad of the Decade. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
10% of the people own 90% of the wealth. 10% of the people own 90% of the wealth. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day Minneapolis Teamsters walked off the job. It was an historic strike that coincided with the pivotal Toledo Autolite and West Coast Waterfront strikes. Local Teamsters, many of whom later founded the Socialist Workers' Party, had been riding a wave of success, having organized the coal yards in February. Especially important was the development of the Cruising Picket Squad. It became a standard in later CIO battles. That spring, union leaders were determined to organize all the truck drivers and warehouse workers in Minneapolis. By May, Local 574 had over 5,000 members. The trucking bosses refused to deal with the union, and so they walked. The flying pickets toured the city and shut down all trucking. Strikers enlisted the support of the unemployed councils. They also provided the structure for a women's auxiliary that produced important strike literature and bulletins, ran soup kitchens that fed thousands of strikers daily, fought scabs and police on the picket lines, and drove picket trucks. Historian Brian Palmer, author of Revolutionary Teamsters, The Minneapolis Trucker Strike of 1934, notes that strike leaders looked to the example of the Illinois Progressive Miners of America when it came to building the women's auxiliary. They too sought to make women an integral part of the strike, thus encroaching on the male world of waged work. Strike headquarters were established, and as Palmer describes, was a beehive of activity on the eve of the strike as union carpenters and plumbers installed stoves, sinks, and serving counters. Union electricians installed communication wiring. Donations of money, food, vehicles, and gas rolled in as the strike revved up. Local 574 was poised to make Minneapolis a union town.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
And he can see no reasons, because there are no reasons. What reason do you need to be sure? Whoa, 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 whoa. Tell me why. I don't like Mondays. Tell me why. I don't like Mondays. Tell me why. I don't like Mondays. I want to shoot. Down.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Oh, going back to the 80s, Boomtown Rats, Bob Geldof. And the thing that gets me is that song is about a mass shooting. And, you know, they've been happening since then, and we did something back then. You had the assault weapons ban. You had us moving in a direction that maybe we don't want, you know, people to have guns who have some mental problems. Maybe we should be doing something. And all of a sudden, the NRA and a whole bunch of cash from who knows where, maybe the Russians, who knows, seem to pop up. And here we go, right back to where we started from. And interestingly enough, today, the tweet that got my attention was from Representative Carolyn Maloney, who evidently wrote Secretary Azar to say, hey, we want to know about the CDC's plans to increase the budget to do some research on gun violence. And look, it's about time. Maybe we should be absolutely doing that. And here to share some of his thoughts on on one, how crazy things are right now, and two, why we need this research. I've asked Ben Jackson to come talk with us. Ben is a fantastic blogger over at Dad of the Decade. He's also one of the co-founders of the No NRA movement. Ben, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks so much for having me, Rick. I'm glad to be here.
So, you know, I played that song for a reason because, you know, it, one of those things that, you know, when I think about school shootings, when I think about mass shootings, that's one of the things from when I was younger that, you know, kind of sticks out in my head.
Sure. You know, I think that, that those of us who are not millennials, right, who can look back at the Columbine shooting almost 20 years ago, 19 years ago now, and remember, you know, what a fundamentally shocking event that was. That nothing like this had happened to us in our history, and we didn't do anything about it. You know, 2 weeks after that horrible event, the NRA went to Denver. I mean, right outside Columbine, and you know, went into this mourning city and said, "We're not going to let you do anything." Right, and for 20 years, we've been having this fight on every single front, every single time that something happens. We don't do anything.
Yeah.
And we don't do anything because they don't let us do it, right?
No, I mean, and the other part of this, Ben, the thing that, you know, enrages me is it's not that we don't even do anything. It's that now you've got these horrible people, and I don't really even have a word for how horrible some of these people who are saying, you know, the shooting in Connecticut was a hoax, it was a false flag, they were all crisis actors, and now you've got these people who go and harass the families of the victims, and you go, you know, how did we get here?
Yeah, you know, we saw with NORA, we went to the NRA convention in Dallas about 10 days ago. And with us, we had both a graduate of Parkland, and we had Fred Guttenberg, who lost his daughter Jamie in the Parkland shooting. And some of those people were there. And you know, I don't know how the heck we got there, but I do know the NRA TV in particular contributes to that, right? Where this idea that every single thing that we try to do where we mention guns, and the mention isn't how do we sell more guns, is met with outright hostility, and not just hostility, but fear, where the NRA is trying to sell fear, that people are coming to take their guns, that what they will call as thugs or gangbangers are going to bang into their house and hurt them, and they need guns everywhere. And so you have these people who in a world where we have very, very divided media hear just this echo chamber, and they hear nothing but fear, and fear breeds stupidity, right? And stupid actions. And I don't know how we got here, but man, are we in a bad spot for it.
Well, I would say we got here because, you know, the NRA flew under the radar for so long. And, yeah, you know, we thought, like, when I was a kid, the NRA, you know, taught gun safety courses. They weren't completely crazy yet. I do remember George H.W. Bush saying, you know what, I'm dropping my membership because you guys have gone too far off the beaten path. But they've only gotten crazier and more militant. And this idea that we can't have any discussion about how we deal with guns in various places is insane to me. You know, look, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. When I was a kid, if you saw somebody walking down the street with a gun, somebody was going to die. Run. I live in a neighborhood now where if you see somebody with a gun, maybe they're going to the free shooting range down the road. There's a very different way of looking at how guns are used in different communities and for different purposes. But the NRA won't let us have any of those conversations because having one to them is the slippery slope of taking everything away.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, I honestly don't believe that they believe that. I think that, you know, what it is more than anything for them is that they are a trade association for gun manufacturers masquerading now as a grassroots membership organization. They're such a far cry from what they used to be, where they did teach gun safety, and they'll make that argument that they still do. But more than half of their revenue, and in 2016, that was $400 million plus dollars. I mean, it's not chump change that they take in. And more than half of that comes from gun companies and from related companies. And any time there's any type of discussion in our government about gun control, about tighter regulations, even on really basic things like allowing the police to confiscate temporarily the guns of somebody they believe to be immediately dangerous. Like the Waffle House shooter who, like the Parkland shooter, they don't want the police to be able to take those guns from somebody immediately dangerous. And that's something I think we can all agree on is pretty basic preventative safety stuff. You know, you do something dangerous, give us your guns, you go to a judge, the judge says, give them back, or no, this person really shouldn't have them.
Right.
And the NRA won't even let basic stuff like that happen. And it's because when those things happen, they sell fewer guns, right?
Exactly.
At the end of the day, it's all about selling guns. And that's killing us. I mean, it's literally killing us.
Literally. But, you know, here's the thing. I always thought that if you had like a domestic violence, you know, conviction or a protection order or something like that, they automatically took your guns. I actually believe that they automatically did it. Evidently, I'm wrong.
Well, so the way that works is that there is, and to be clear, there is federal law that says if you have a domestic violence conviction, you're a prohibited possessor. Or if you have a permanent domestic violence restraining order, that also makes you what's called a prohibited possessor. You can't have, you're not allowed to possess firearms under federal law. But the difficulty is that there is a really dangerous period of time from the time when the incident happens, when the police are brought to somebody's house, say for a domestic violence incident. In the heat of that moment, somebody has called the police and said, there's something wrong here. The police in many places cannot take weapons from that person until that person is either served with a permanent domestic violence restraining order or that person is convicted of domestic abuse. So in that period of time, which in some places could be weeks or even months, that person is allowed to possess their guns even if they've made threats, right? Even if they said, I'm going to kill this person. If they're out, they can't, in many places, they're still allowed to have their guns. The same is true of stalking. The same is true of threats of school shootings. And the NRA actively works against this. They just campaigned against laws in Tennessee that would allow this to happen, where the Waffle House shooting happened, right? Like, there's really, really basic stuff. It's mind-boggling, A, how that isn't law, and B, when you look at how the NRA prevents that from happening, it's a complete perversion of our democracy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've had conversations with NRA members, and, you know, some of them are rational. You know, the membership, you know, people who are the members don't seem to be the irrational ones because, you know, everyone that I've talked to is in favor of, you know, more stringent background checks, you know, mental health checks, even trigger locks. And you know, one of the ones that I found that we actually have the technology for is it's got like a fingerprint sensor to where the only person who can fire the gun is somebody who their print is evidently in it. So that there's like a gun that you only the person who owns it and should be firing it gets to do that. That seems sane and rational to me.
Yeah, it shouldn't be harder to open your iPhone than it is to fire your gun, right? Like, and it's absolutely true that all of these things are things that could happen. And I will say that the NRA and the NRA membership are two different things, right? That the NRA is not serving the interests of its membership because its membership aren't where it gets the majority of its funds. You know, if you poll NRA members, most of them do want improved background checks. Most of them would prefer bans on bump stocks. You know, many of them even would say if you can look at assault weapons or things that are easily modified or closing the gun show loophole or all of these really easy things that will save lives, most of the members want that. It's the NRA leadership, right? It's the NRA leadership that is representing the gun companies and not its membership. And, you know, I really hope that the NRA members themselves will do something about it.
Do you think that's possible?
Join us in this movement.
I mean, do you think it's possible?
So. And, you know what? So the NRA is structured in a way that makes it really hard to do that. They don't publish their bylaws. Only a certain percentage of their members are allowed to vote for their board. You know, you have to be either a lifetime member or a member in good standing for 5 years, which makes it, a financial commitment. Only a small percentage of their board officers are up for election every year. So it makes it really hard to do that, right, from inside the organization. What I would love to see happen is, you know, NRA members join us in this movement, join a different organization. Or leave the NRA. Just say, you know what, you don't represent me, and because of what you're doing, people are dying. And we've had these conversations with NRA members. You know, you've had them. we had them in Dallas. Most of those conversations were cordial and even ended with common ground and were friendly. Our issue isn't with the membership. Our issue is with the leadership who tries to scare their membership about, you know, the mythical gun grabbers.
But Ben, you're the no NRA. You're
sure.
Just the messaging alone is you want to take their guns.
No. The messaging is we want to take the NRA's money and our government. We don't. If you look at anything that we've said, all of our tweets, all of our publicly available information.
Yeah, that takes research. That takes people.
Members. Yeah,
Ben,
sure.
That takes actually looking into it. What I'm saying is the NRA, I mean, the natural knee-jerk reaction is you're the no NRA, you're anti-NRA, you're anti-gun, therefore you're bad.
Sure, but you know what? It's also you're progressive and you're bad. Or frankly, in most of their membership, you're urban and African-American and you're bad. You know, if you are anybody who is not trying to sell more guns, then you're bad. And, you know, I'm not going to play that game with the NRA, you know. No matter what I say, the problem is the NRA leadership, and the problem is what they spend on politics. And they're not going to, you know, as any threat to that, they're going to fight hard against. And we can no longer ignore that, right? There's nothing else in this country that kills 35,000 people a year, and we try to do more of it. And that's exactly what's happening with guns right now.
And the weird thing about it is now they've got somebody even worse than the last guy. I think Ali North is the worst choice, and I think his choice was a thumb in the nose of every liberal, progressive, Democrat person with sane thinking. I think that was done on purpose and deliberately just to enrage and inflame.
For sure. And, you know, I really actually think and I hope that it has a chance of backfiring on them, because here's the thing is that the NRA was talking a little bit about some activists who did some pretty stark protesting at Chris Cox's house, who's sort of their head lobbyist. And Ali North said that even in Jim Crow times, we didn't have things like this, right?
Yeah.
He compared protesting against gun violence to an era where we actually had an epidemic of lynching of African-Americans, right? That's how far gone this leadership is, and it's disgusting, and it's something that I can't imagine any other membership organization of its size and of its financial prowess in this country being able to have a leader like that and not have them resign. And I say that when I look at the White House, and I think maybe we're past that point, right?
No, you're right.
But to
highlight that, I mean, he called unarmed kids who are just saying, please stop shooting us. He called them terrorists.
Yeah. Yeah, he absolutely did. And you know what? I've met these kids, and they are not terrorists. They are the future. They are brilliant and inspiring, and they know more about gun violence than Ali North or Dana Lash or Grant Stinchfield or any of these people. They know it in a way that I hope, I really do seriously mean, I hope, and this is why we're having this fight with the NRA, is that I don't want anyone else to experience that, what these kids experience, what their families know. And they do know better than the NRA about what gun violence looks like. And the NRA should, the leadership should really sit down and listen to them. And instead, they are shooting the messenger instead of listening to the message.
No, I mean, they're attacking them. They're actively attacking them. Let me ask you a last line of questioning, because today it came up that Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar opened the door to the possibility of expanding the federal gun violence research. I think that's long overdue. I think it's something that we should have been doing all along. Do you think it's going to happen?
I think it has to. I think that, you know, there is, regardless of the presidency, regardless of the NRA, there is a tremendous upswell in voter interest in gun violence right now. And if you look at, you know, if you Google CDC and things that are killing kids, right? So if you Google CDC and texting and driving, you're going to find a whole list of studies. If you Google CDC and Tide Pods, you're probably going to find stuff. And if you Google CDC and guns, there's nothing.
Yeah.
There's nothing but a series of stories about why the CDC doesn't fund gun research. And I think that the political pressure that's on the government right now, at least the government that functions like a normal government and not a, you know, banana republic anymore, has to listen. I think that they have to listen, and they have to allow the CDC to examine what is legitimately a public health crisis.
So how do we join the No NRA movement? How do we all get involved?
Great. So anyone who's interested in learning more about us, you can visit us on our website at www.noranow.org. You can follow us on Twitter at NoRA4USA. There's a whole bunch of information about us there. On our website, you can join our mailing list. We are planning our next event, which is going to be coming up in July in Chicago, and more information will be coming on that now. But the best way right now is social media and our website.
There you go. Good stuff. I look forward to talking to you again. Great having you on. I appreciate it.
Sounds good. Thanks so much, Rick.
Good stuff, Ben Jackson. Again, somebody that you certainly want to be following if you're a Twitter fan. If you're on Twitter, most certainly follow him as well. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Think of all the roads. Think of all the crossings. Taking steps is easy. Standing still is hard.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1979. That was the day we lost one of the giants of the U.S. labor movement, A. Philip Randolph. A. Philip Randolph spent his life working for black workers and the cause of labor. He organized the first national black union to be recognized by the American Federation of Labor, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. The fight for union recognition took 12 years, and the porters signed their first contract in 1937. Randolph went on to lead the effort to desegregate war industries and armed services during and after World War II. He was one of the leading organizers of the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, one of the most memorable actions of the civil rights movement. He also worked tirelessly to break down discrimination within the labor movement. He was elected the first black vice president of the AFL-CIO in 1955. Randolph's dedication to the cause of labor was summed up when he said, quote, "The essence of trade unionism is social uplift. The labor movement has been the haven for the dispossessed, the despised, the neglected, the downtrodden, the poor." But Randolph also consistently declared that no movement for social justice can be complete unless it is also inclusive. While organizing for the desegregation of the war industries during World War II, Phillips argued, quote, "Equality is the heart and essence of democracy. Freedom and justice, equality of opportunity in industry, in labor unions, schools and colleges, government, politics, and before the law. There must be no dual standard of justice, no dual rights, privileges, duties, or responsibilities of citizenship. No dual forms of freedom."
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
The most important issues of the day. This is The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Lots going on. Rex Tillerson giving the big speech there at VMI. And I got to be honest, everyone's saying veiled comments. Nothing veiled about what he said. He said, when we as people, a free people, go wobbly on the truth, even on what seems the most trivial of matters, we go wobbly on America. Nothing veiled about that, Donnie. Here to talk about what's going on around the world and in Washington, D.C., Justin Duckham, Talk Media News. Justin, thanks for taking time for us.
A former oil tycoon / Secretary of State for an administration that was certainly going off the rails and who pretty much tried to gut that, is now the voice of reason. So welcome to the resistance.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, and I'm reading through all of the other comments, you know, talking about what facts are and that we have to have common facts. And I'm going, where exactly were you during the brief period of time you were in Trump's cabinet?
Yeah, I mean, it was a weird time indeed. I mean, on one hand, you know, he was somebody who worked really hard to make sure that the press was not on the plane with him, kept reporters at arm's length, really limited the amount of briefings that people had, and just sort of transparency with that. But on the other hand, he also pointedly did not deny calling Trump a moron. So, you know, his relationship with the truth and transparency is, a little bit of a mixed bag.
And you know, he's got to be a little chafed. I mean, being caught with his pants down and all when he got fired. If the reports are true that he got fired on the can somewhere in Africa.
I mean, according to John Kelly, that's how it went down, which is pretty shocking on the face of it, and just kind of shows the, sort of the foresight that members of the Trump administration have when it comes to making sure you don't have somebody like this who is a high-profile name coming out and disparaging the administration afterwards. Probably not the best.
I'm waiting. I'm following the Twitter account. I'm waiting for the manic meltdown. I'm waiting for Twitter Fest 2018 as Trump loses his ever-loving freaking mind.
I mean, you know, after Omarosa left the administration, she pointed out that, you know, Trump did say a number of things behind closed doors that the White House had denied. So, you know, we'll see if they're really willing to shake this cage and what could come of it if they do.
Yeah, did she leave or did they throw her out? Because I'm getting conflicting reports.
They threw her out, but Trump tried to do it nicely, but it
all right. Didn't work. There you go. So the wheels are coming off the bus with the North Korea deal, huh?
That's what it looks like right now. And we are seeing a very odd response from the White House in the sense that, you know, Trump has been threatening for a while to get up and leave the table, to walk away from this, and to pretty much let it just go. And now that we are seeing North Korea, I guess, playing hardball, that's just not the case. We're seeing an oddly cautious response from the administration. Today, Trump said that he did not hear anything from North Korea and that they're pretty much just going to wait and see. We had some comments from the White House Press Secretary, Sarah Sanders, who said that, you know, they still have not yet been able to confirm the South Korean reports that, you know, they're canceling the talks with the South Korean government and are threatening to walk away from the table if the administration fails to drop their call for a full denuclearization, and now saying that they are not going for a Libya-style disarmament, something that we saw take place previously, something that is a slap in the face for the National Security Advisor, John Bolton, who has been pushing for that, and something that's showing that, you know, this may not be going the way that a lot of people in the administration were, you know, expecting just a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, Mr. Art of the Deal seems to have turned into a teenage girl waiting for that second phone call.
I mean, it's strange. You know, just 6 months ago, we were having Donald Trump coming out and calling him Little Rocket Man, calling him fat, making all of these just terrifying remarks on, Twitter that were really kind of bringing us to the brink of a nuclear conflict. And now we're just seeing total radio silence. Him, you know, when asked today if he was still going to be pressing for denuclearization, responded with the one word answer of yeah, briefly in the Oval Office. So, just a very strange time.
Yeah, that's the perfect response. That's exactly how I want my kids to respond to any question. Yeah. Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
I mean, and I listened to the audio clip many times today, and that was exactly how it went down when he was asked that by the pool in the Oval Office during a meeting with the, you know, president of Uzbekistan. So, yeah.
Yeah. You know what would have happened if I'd have done that? My mother would have smacked me across the back of the head. And that's what I think he needs at this point. I think at some point we've got to look at this guy and go, look, it's a failed experiment. Let's show him the door. Let's move along, different direction, something, because everything he touches seems to turn, you know, he's got the anti-Midas touch.
I mean, I'm sure that's how we're also going to be discussing this after his presidency. This is historic, and I'm sure it's going to get one of those, you know, historical whitewashing things where we're going to talk about this being the, you know, strange U.S. experiment when it comes to populism and, you know, saying people tried, it didn't work, let's all be friends after, and then everything got better. Just like we've seen every time we have some kind of, uncomfortable historical truth. So,
So this could be the new kind of 9/11 moment where we all come back together. This could be such a cataclysmic presidency and be horrible. And I'm okay with this, actually. If this is rock bottom and we can move on from this and move forward, I'm A-okay. But let me ask you, does this mean that the Republicans are going to start pulling back their requests for Donny to get the Nobel Peace Prize?
I mean, that does not look like it's going to be moving forward right now. And I think, honestly, you know, to a lot of people that I've spoken to about the Nobel Prize, that's probably the only thing that's keeping the president, you know, from really unleashing on Twitter for this. You know, the Nobel Prize is an aspirational, you know, thing that can be dangled in front of these talks to try to get people on their best behaviors. You know, Trump has said that, you know, he doesn't want to say that he's looking for the Nobel Prize, but then was ready immediately after with a very good soundbite saying, "What I want is peace for the world. I want a world victory." You know, something that was oddly well thought out for somebody who is, you know, usually pretty off the cuff.
Yeah.
So it's pretty safe to say he wants it. And I think the fact that, you know, he thinks that he's within striking distance, and, you know, for all we know, he could very well be, along with, you know, the South Koreans and others who are involved in this process. I think that's probably, you know, more to say for why he's putting on a polite face over this, more so than, you know, he really thinks that, he's going to be able to negotiate this.
Yeah, well, he needs the money. I mean, because I agree with Michelle Wolf. He's not as rich as he says he is. So let's move on. The Trump Jr. transcripts released today. Anything?
Just a lot of weird information that came out for this. The big one that I was really focusing on today was the response that he had to the Russian meeting, at least how he portrayed it to investigators. You know, initially there was a statement from Donald Trump Jr. where he came out and said that this was primarily just about adoption. After that, we had an updated statement. And then we had reports coming out saying that Donald Trump actually dictated the initial response. Donald Trump Jr. could not give a clear answer on that, said that, you know, maybe he had spoken to Hope Hicks. Maybe the president had talked to Hope Hicks. Maybe that was how it, you know, happened. But he just wasn't really able to say, which is, right, you know, shocking in the face of it, since that was a major story for quite some time. And then he also couldn't explain who the person with the blocked number who he called immediately after hearing about the meeting was. And, you know, as anybody who's covered Trump for a while, they know that, you know, he and people who are in his circle use blocked numbers quite a bit. You know, I know that I've received blocked phone calls from those within the Trump orbit at least more than once. So it's, you know, just a strange story, one that's getting stranger and one that's showing that he's just not able to present what exactly happened in any way that, you know, passes the smell test.
Yeah, or it's one of those 16 phones that they found in Cohen's office. Could be one of those. But here's the thing, you know, to be honest, maybe he doesn't know what happened because maybe they wouldn't allow him to the big people's table. You know, he's usually relegated to the kids' table. And it sounds to me like they're going to try and throw Hope Hicks under the bus for this.
I mean, that was something that they floated on, you know, very early. And really, honestly, if we look at it, it was probably one of the reasons why she left. You know, she was keeping, I guess, Trump at bay for a lot of this. But, you know, at a certain point was too appealing of a scapegoat to, you know, ignore. So, you know, putting this on her, saying, you know, maybe she heard about it, I'm not really sure, playing that sort of weird little dance, you know, I'm sure is not making any friends with people who have left the administration at this point.
Yeah, and finally, the big financial disclosure documents actually had the Stormy payoff in there. Are we surprised by that?
You know, it was a weird situation. There was no way that Trump could really get out of it due to the statements that had been made by Giuliani previously. And now we have just sort of a little footnote saying that these, you know, payments were made and listed as a liability after Michael Cohen sought reimbursement. You know, some confusion over why it was not included on the initial form. The Trump team saying that they wanted to do this because of, you know, some high-minded form of transparency.
Uh-huh.
The Office of Government Ethics saying, no, in fact, this needs to be listed. This is a, you know, legitimate liability that needs to be on this form. And then giving, you know, what the former OGE director, Walter Schaub, described as a criminal referral to the Justice Department, saying, you know, look, this wasn't on the previous one, and it really should have been. So, you know, this is a disclosure, something that shows a little bit more information, but is certainly not putting this matter to rest.
Yeah, I mean, but and there was a number larger than the 130,000. So how much are there other payoffs? Are there other people that we don't know about?
It was conveniently within the range of 100,000 to, I believe, 250,000. So, you know, certainly enough wiggle room to include payment for or payments for others as well. If you know that comes up,
you got a couple of those laying around, and you know, it is what it is. It's just amazing to me, and I'm. I guess I'm not surprised given the Giuliani statements and everyone saying that he was flubbing. I think they masterfully laid out the whole gaffe machine that was the Giuliani weekend, just so they could make all this stuff up and try and make the puzzle pieces fit together.
Yeah, I mean Giuliani has been the gift that's that keeps on giving. It's you know, it's taken a while for him to get his facts straight. And, you know, during that period of time, we've had a much different response than we've seen previously. We've had a lot of these things come to light. We've seen more, you know, answers put on the table, more sort of incidents of the administration moving the goalposts and trying to re-explain things, you know, trying to explain that people who should have known things didn't know when they did, and just painting a picture that's much more chaotic, but also much more illuminating than it was just a little while ago.
As the jacket tightens, we're going to find out. I'm hoping soon there'll be some indictments, some perp walks. Let the fun begin. Justin, appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Good stuff. Our good friend Justin Duckham, Talk Media News. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
For and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1979. That was the day that A. Philip Randolph, perhaps the most significant African-American figure in the U.S. labor movement, passed away. He was 90 years old. During World War I, Randolph and Chandler Owen founded the monthly magazine The Messenger in Harlem. From the pages of The Messenger, Randolph called for an end to employment discrimination against black workers. A few years later, sleeping car porters who worked on trains for the Pullman Car Company wanted to form a union. They knew they faced an uphill battle because the Pullman Company was notoriously anti-union. They reached out to A. Philip Randolph, inviting him to lead their effort. Since he did not work for the company, Randolph could not be fired for talking about the union. He accepted the job. It took 12 long years of struggle, but in 1937, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters signed their first union contract. They became the first national black union of the American Federation of Labor. During World War II, Randolph organized a planned march on Washington, calling for an end to discrimination in defense industry employment. He called off the march when President Franklin Delano Roosevelt conceded and issued Executive Order 8802, prohibiting the defense industry from engaging in acts of discrimination. In 1963, Randolph helped to plan another march on Washington, D.C. This march, he did not cancel. The March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom drew 250,000 civil rights supporters to the nation's capital. That day, Randolph shared the podium with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who delivered his famous I Have a Dream speech. A. Philip Randolph fought more than half a century for labor rights, for civil rights, and for dignity.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. The Pennsylvania Auditor General, Eugene DePasquale, who we haven't had on the program for a while. We need to get him back on. He had a statement today about the U.S. Senate voting to reinstate The net neutrality rules, he said, today's Senate vote to stop the Trump administration's effort to allow internet service providers to control the content and speed at which consumers get information on the web is a victory for all Americans. He says, I urge the U.S. House of Representatives to follow the Senate's lead to keep the internet open and accessible to all. Well, Eugene, the reality is the House isn't going to do it. The House is bought, paid for, crazy. And this, again, why November is so very important. I look at this as another one of those we knew in 2016, and I was talking about this all during the election season, that, you know, this is one of those issues. Supreme Court, top of the ticket, all of the federal bench seats, all of the district court seats, and, you know, the policies being rammed through. This one being at the top of the list, because this is the control of information. Handing this over to Comcast and the big ISP providers, the power that they have to get into your screen, to in your head, to control what you see, what you hear, what you read. I mean, you think about the consolidation of our media into the hands of so few. You know, there was a statistic I read a couple years ago that 80% of every message, everything we see, hear, and read is controlled by five multinational corporations. And you stop and think about the power that we've given those five. You know, in a lot of places, the TV and the radio stations are owned by the same company. And some of them have really aggressive, crazy agendas. You know, kind of look at, you know, think of that one that wanted to air the Hillary movie. Giving them that kind of power of our print media, of our radio airwaves, of our television airwaves, and now the one last place where programs like mine have equal access to get out to people who have multi-millions of dollars. To where if you have a message that people want to hear, they can find it. In the brave new world that is the Agent Pi's Restoring Internet Freedom Order world. And I love that language. I mean, that isn't that brilliant? Restoring internet freedom. It almost sounds great. It almost sounds like, hey, we're getting something. It almost sounds like somebody else was controlling the internet. And now, thanks to Agent Pi, it's free. Only the problem is the price is going to double. You're going to get slower speeds, and you're not going to see things that they don't want you to see. And anybody who can pay to get into your screen, you're going to get hammered with it. I mean, you know, I was thinking about some of those sci-fi movies from like the 1980s and early 90s, where and the one I don't remember the name of it, but as you're walking down the corridor in this one movie, you know, every screen next to you changed, and it was all something that you wanted or something that you desired, and probably even not even something you even thought about. But as you're walking through this thing, they're, you know, just bombarding you with all of these seductive messages that play to your fantasy, to your wants, to your needs. And this is where we're going. Corporate America is going to be in our head every minute of every day. And at some point, my fear is that at birth, they're just going to implant a chip in your head. Don't worry about it. This is going to be your credit card, your paycheck. This is going to be, you know, your papers. You won't have to carry papers. Don't have to worry about your social security number or any of that stuff. We're just going to implant it right into your head. You won't need internet access. It'll just take over. I know it sounds crazy, right? Sadly, it's kind of where we're almost going. You know, 30 years ago, you'd have told me we'd be chipping kids like dogs. And I said, no, you're crazy. You wouldn't do that. Yeah. It was almost 16 years ago today that someone offered to chip my kid when she was born. And you go, no. No. What happens if I don't want her found? You know, what if she wants to go somewhere? Who then? Scary stuff. I mean, this technology, while great, making our lives better, scary kind of stuff. And this net neutrality, doing away with net neutrality, is dangerous for democracy. Because if you think things are bad now, you think that the echo chamber of the right corporate wing of the Republican Party is powerful now, wait till they fully institute this. Then you get no voices of dissent. You get no balance. And to be honest, that was one of the reasons I started this program almost 13 years ago, to add some balance to the airwaves and have a different point of view than what was being shoved down our throats every day. But we will see. It'll be interesting to see how the House votes on this. I'll take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Controversial, thought-provoking, opinionated. Rick Smith.